ligature that might have been threaded through the eyebolts, which we also can't unscrew without risking the introduction of new tool marks, assuming we use a tool such as pliers. The biggest threat is inadvertently eradicating any possible prints. In fact, the conditions and lighting are so bad that we shouldn't be examining anything here, really. I get an idea. If you can hand me a couple baggies, I tell Marino, and tape. He hands me two small, transparent plastic bags. I slip one over each eyebolt and carefully wrap tape around the top of the bag, careful not to touch any part of the bolt or the ceiling. I climb back down while Marino opens his toolbox. "Hate to do this to you," he says to Kiffin, who hovers outside the door, hands deep in her pockets, trying to keep warm. "But I'm gonna have to cut out part of the ceiling." "Like that's gonna make much difference at this point," she says in a voice of resignation. Or is it indifference, I detect? "May as well," she adds. I am still wondering why the fire only smoldered. This has really got me stuck. I ask Kiffin what type of linens and mattress cover were on the bed. "Well, they were green," she seems sure of herself on this point. "The bedspread was dark green, sort of like the color the doors are painted. Not that we know what happened to the linens. The sheets were white." "Do you have any idea what they were made of?" I ask. "I'm pretty sure the bedspreads are polyester." Polyester is so combustible that I try to remember never to wear synthetic materials when I fly. If we have a crash landing and there is a fire, the last thing I want against my flesh is polyester. I may as well douse myself with gasoline. If a polyester bedspread had been on the bed when the fire was set, more than likely the entire room would have gone up in flames, and quickly. "Where did you get the mattresses?" I ask her. She hesitates. She doesn't want to tell me. "Well," she finally gets around to what I believe is the truth. "New ones are awfully expensive. I get second-hand ones when I can."
"From where?"
"Well, from that prison they closed down in Richmond a few years back," she tells me.
"Spring Street?"
"That's right. Now, I didn't get anything that I wouldn't sleep on myself." She defends her choice in fine bedding. "Got the newest ones from them." This might explain why the mattress only smoldered and never really caught fire. In hospitals and prisons, mattresses are treated heavily with flame retardants. This also suggests that whoever set the fire wouldn't have had any reason to know he was trying to burn a mattress specially treated with flame retardants. And, of course, common sense would have it that this person also did not hang around long enough to know that the fire went out on its own. "Mrs. Kiffin," I say, "is there a Bible in every room?"
"The one thing folks don't steal."
She avoids my question, taking on a suspicious tone of voice again. "Do you know why this one in here is open to Ecclesiastes?"
"Now, I don't go around opening them. I just leave them on the dresser. I didn't open it."
She hesitates, then announces, "He must have been murdered, or everybody wouldn't be going to all this trouble."
"We have to look into every possibility," Marino remarks as he climbs back up the ladder, a small backsaw in hand that is helpful at scenes like this, because the teeth are hardened and aren't angled. They can cut elements in situ or in place, such as trim molding, baseboard, pipes, or in this instance, joists.
"Business has been hard," Mrs. Kiffin says. "I'm on my own because my husband's on the road all the time."
"What does your husband do?" I inquire.
"A truck driver for overland transfer."
Marino begins popping out drywall tiles from the ceiling around the ones the eyebolts are screwed through.
"I don't imagine he's home much," I say.
Her lower lip trembles almost imperceptibly, and her eyes brighten with pain.
"I don't need a murder. Oh, Lord, it's gonna hurt me bad."
"Doc, you mind holding the light for me?"
Marino doesn't respond to her sudden need for sympathy. "Murder hurts many people." I train the flashlight on the ceiling, my good arm steadying the ladder again. "That's a sad, unfair fact, Mrs. Kiffin." Marino starts sawing, wood dust drifting down.
"I've never had anybody die here," she whines some more. "Not much worse can happen to a place."
"Hey," Marino quips to her above the noise of sawing. "You'll probably get business from the publicity."
She gives him a black look.
"Those types can just stay the hell away."
From the photographs Stanfield showed me, I recognize the area of wall where the body was propped up, and I get the general idea where the clothing was found. I imagine the victim nude on the bed, his arms strung up by rope threaded through the eye bolts. He might be kneeling or even sitting, only partially hoisted up. But the crucifix position and gag would impair his breathing. He is panting, fighting for breath, his heart palpitating furiously in panic and pain as he watches someone plug in the heat gun, as he hears air blow out when the trigger is pulled. I have never related to the human desire to torture. I know the dynamics, that it is all about control, the ultimate abuse of power. But I can't comprehend deriving satisfaction, vindication, and certainly not sexual pleasure out of causing any living creature pain. My central nervous system spikes and surges, my pulse pounds. I am sweating beneath my coat, even though it is cold enough inside the room to see our breath. "Mrs. Kiffin," I say as Marino strokes the saw.
5 days. A business special? This time of year?"
I pause as confusion dances across her face. She is not inside my mind. She does not see what I see. She can't begin to imagine the horror I am reconstructing as I stand inside this cheap motel with its second-hand prison mattresses.
"Why would he check in for 5 days the week of Christmas?" I want to know.
"Did he say anything at all that might have given you a hint as to why he was here, what he was doing, where he was from, aside from your observation that he didn't sound local?"
"I don't ask." She watches Marino work. "Maybe I should. Some people talk a lot and tell you more than you want to know. Some don't want you in their business."
"What feeling did you get from him?"
I keep prodding her.
"Well, Mr. Peanut didn't like him."
"Who the hell is Mr. Peanut?"
Marino reaches down with a ceiling tile that is attached by an eye bolt to a 4-inch section of joist.
"Our dog. You probably noticed her when you came in. I know it's kind of a funny name for a female that's had as many puppies as that one, but Zack named her. Mr. Peanut just barked her head off right when that man showed up at the door. Wouldn't come near him, the fur just standing up on her back."
"Or maybe your dog was barking and upset because someone else was around. Someone you didn't see," I suggest.
"Could be."
A second ceiling tile drops, and the ladder shakes as Marino descends. He goes back into his toolbox for a roll of freezer paper and evidence tape and begins wrapping the ceiling tiles in neat packages as I walk into the bathroom and shine the light around. Everything is institutional white, the top of the counter scarred with yellowish burns, probably from guests parking lit cigarettes while they shave or put on makeup or fix their hair. I see something else Stanfield missed. A single strand of dental floss dangles inside the toilet. It is draped over the edge of the bowl and trapped under the seat. With a gloved hand, I pick it up. It is about 1 foot long, several inches of it wet from toilet water, and the midsection of it pale red, as if someone flossed his teeth and his gums bled. Because this latest find isn't perfectly dry, I don't seal it in plastic. I place it in a square of freezer paper, which I fold into a jeweler's envelope. We probably have DNA. The question is, whose? Marino and I return to his truck at 1:30, and Mr. Peanut flies out of the house when Kiffin yanks open the front door to go back inside the house. The dog chases us as we pull out, barking. I watch in the side mirror as Kiffin yells at her dog.
"You get here right now!"
She angrily claps her hands.
"Come here now!"
"Some asshole take time out from torture to floss his teeth?"
Marino starts in.
"Like, what the hell is that about? Or more likely, it's been hanging out in the toilet since last Christmas."
Mr. Peanut is now right by my door, the truck bumping over the unpaved drive that leads through woods to Route 5.
"Come here now!" Kiffin bellows as she comes down the steps, hands smack, smack, smack.
Goddamn dog, Marino complains.
Stop! I'm afraid we are going to run over the poor animal. Marino stamps the brakes and the truck lurches to a halt. Mr. Peanut jumps up, barking, her head bobbing in and out of my window.
What in the world?
I am baffled. The dog was scarcely interested in us when we first showed up several hours ago.
Get back here!
Kiffin is coming after her dog. Behind her, a child fills the doorway. Not the little boy we saw earlier, but someone as tall as Kiffin. I get out of the truck, and Mr. Peanut starts wagging her tail. She nuzzles my hand. The poor, wretched creature is dirty and smells bad. I get her by the collar and tug her in the direction of her family, but she doesn't want to leave the truck. Come on, I talk to her. Let's get you home before you get run over. Kiffin strides up, just livid. She pops the dog hard on the top of the head. Mr. Peanut bleats like an injured lamb, tail tucked, cowering.
You learn to mind, you hear me?
Kiffin furiously wags her finger at her dog.
Get in the house!
Mr. Peanut sneaks behind me.
Get!
The dog sits down in the dirt behind me, pressing its trembling body against my legs. The person I saw in the doorway has vanished, but Zack has emerged on the porch. He is dressed in jeans and a sweatshirt that are way too big.
Come here, Peanut,
he sings out, snapping his fingers. He sounds as frightened as the dog.
Zack! Don't you make me tell you again to get your butt inside the house!
Zack's mother shouts at him. Cruelty. Leave, and the dog will be beaten. Maybe the child will. Bev Kiffin is an out-of-control, frustrated woman. Life has made her feel powerless, and beneath her skin she seethes with hurt and anger, the unfairness of it all. Or maybe she is just plain bad. And maybe poor Mr. Peanut is running after Marino's truck because the dog wants us to take her with us, to save her. That fantasy enters my mind. Mrs. Kiffin, I say in the calm voice of authority, that cool, cool voice I reserve for times when I intend to threaten the living shit out of somebody. Don't you touch Mr. Peanut again unless you do it gently. I have this special thing about people who hurt animals. Her face darkens and anger glints. I fix my stare dead center on her pupils. There are laws against cruelty to animals, Mrs. Kiffin, I say, and beating Mr. Peanut is not a good example to set in front of your children. I hint that I spotted a second child she has failed to mention to us thus far. She steps back from me, turns and walks off toward the house. Mr. Peanut sits, looking up at me.
You go home, I tell her as my heart breaks. Go on, sweetie. You need to go home.
Zack comes down the steps and runs up to us. He takes the dog by the collar, squats, and scratches between her ears, talking to her.
Be good. Don't go making Mama mad, Mr. Peanut.
Please, he says, looking up at me.
She just don't like it 'cause you're taking her baby buggy.
This jolts me, but I don't let it show. I get down to Zack's level and pet Mr. Peanut, trying to block out that her musky stench triggers memories of Sean Dunn again. Nausea twists my stomach and makes my mouth water.
The baby buggy's hers?
I ask Zack.
When she has puppies, I take them on rides in it, Zack tells me.
Why was it over there by the picnic table, Zack? I ask. I thought maybe some campers might have left it there. He shakes his head, petting Mr. Peanut.
Uh-uh, it's Mr. Peanut's buggy, isn't it, Mr. Peanut?
I gotta go in. He gets up, glancing back furtively at the open front door. I tell you what, I get up too. We just need to look at Mr. Peanut's buggy, but when we're done, I promise to bring it back.
Okay.
He tugs the dog after him, half running, half yanking. I stare after them as they go inside the house and shut the door. I stand in the middle of the dirt drive in the shadow of scrub pines, hands in my pockets, watching, because I have no doubt Bev Kiffin is watching me. On the street it is called signifying, making your presence known. My business isn't finished here. I'll be back.
Chapter 23. We head east on Route 5, and I am mindful of the time. Even if I could conjure up Lucy's helicopter, I would never make it back to Anna's house by 2. I pull out my wallet and find the card Berger wrote her phone numbers on. There is no answer at her hotel, and I leave a message for her to pick me up at 6 p.m. Marino is silent as I slip the cell phone back inside my satchel. He stares straight ahead, his truck rumbling loudly along the winding narrow road. He is processing what I just told him about the baby carriage. Bev Kiffin, of course, lied to us.
"The whole thing out there, wow," he finally says, shaking his head. "Talk about a creepy feeling. Like there were all these eyes watching everything we were doing. Like that place has a whole life of its own nobody knows nothing about."
"She knows," I reply. "She knows something. That much is obvious, Marino. She made a point of telling us the baby carriage was left by the people who abandoned the campsite. She volunteered that without pause. Wanted us to think it."
"Why?"
"Those people don't exist, whoever was supposedly staying out in that tent. If the hares turn out to be Sean Dunn's, then I'm gonna have to entertain the idea she let him stay out there, and that's why she got all hinky about it."
The vision of Sean Dunn showing up at her motel office and asking for a place to stay for the night shorts out my imagination. I can't picture it. Le Loup-Garou, as he calls himself, would not take such a chance. His modus operandi, as we know it, was not to show up at anyone's door unless he intended to murder and maul that person. As we know it. As we know it, I keep thinking. The truth is, we know less than we did 2 weeks ago.
We have to start all over, I tell Marino. We've defined someone without information, and now what? We made the mistake of profiling him and then believing our projection.
Well, there are dimensions to him we've completely missed, and even though he's locked up, he isn't.
Marino gets out his cigarettes.
Do you understand what I'm saying? I go on. In our arrogance, we decided what he's like, based it on scientific evidence, and came up with what in truth is an assumption, a caricature. He's not a werewolf. He's a human being, and no matter how evil he is, he has many facets, and now we're finding them. Hell, it was obvious on the videotape. Why are we so damn slow on the uptake? I don't want Vander going to that motel alone.
Good point. Marino reaches for the phone. I'll go to the motel with him, and you can take my truck back to Richmond.
There was someone in the doorway, I say. Did you see him? He was big.
Huh, he says. I didn't see anyone. Just the little kid, what's his name? Zack. And the dog.
I saw someone else, I insist.
I'll check it out. You got Vander's number?
I give it to him, and he calls. Vander was already on his way, and his wife gives Marino a cell phone number. I stare out the window at wooded residential developments with large colonial homes set back far from the streets. Elegant Christmas decorations shine through trees.
"Yeah, there's some strange shit out there," Marino is telling Vander by cell phone. "So yours truly here is gonna be your bodyguard."
He ends the call, and we are quiet for a moment. Last night seems to fill the rumbling space between us in the truck. "How long have you known?" I finally ask Marino one more time, not at all satisfied with what he told me in Anna's driveway when I walked him out to his truck after midnight. "When exactly did Ryder tell you he was instigating a special grand jury investigation, and what was his reason?"
"You hadn't even finished a damn autopsy yet."
Marino lights a cigarette.
"Bray was still on your table, to be exact. Ryder gets me on the phone and says he don't want you doing her post, and I tell him, 'So what you want me to do? Walk in the morgue and order her to drop her scalpel and put her hands up in the air? The dumb shit.'"
Marino blows out smoke as my dismay folds into a scary shape inside my brain.
"That's why he didn't ask your permission to come snoop around your house, either," Marino adds.
The snooping part, at least, I had already figured out.
"He wanted to see if the cops came across anything."
He pauses to tap an ash.
"Like a chipping hammer.
especially one with maybe Bray's blood on it.
The one he tried to attack me with may very well have her blood on it, I reply reasonably, calmly, as anxiety inches through me.
Problem is, the hammer with her blood on it was found in your house, Marino reminds me of a fact.
Of course it was. He brought it to my house so he could use it on me.
And yeah, it does have her blood on it, Marino keeps talking. They already did the DNA. Never seen the labs move so fast as they are these days, and you can guess why. The governor's got his eye on everything going on, in case his chief medical examiner turns out to be some wacko murderer.
He sucks on the cigarette and glances over at me.
And another thing, Doc. Don't know if Berger might have mentioned this to you, but the chipping hammer you say you bought at the hardware store? It ain't been found.
What? I am incredulous, then furious.
So the only one at your house is the one with Bray's blood on it. One hammer, found at your house, and it's got Bray's blood.
He makes his point, not without some reluctance. You know why I bought that hammer, I reply, as if my argument is with him. I wanted to see if it matched up with the pattern of her injuries, and it was definitely in my house. If it wasn't there when you guys went through everything, then either you overlooked it or someone took it.
You remember where you had it last?
I used it in the kitchen on chicken to see what the injuries looked like, and also what kind of pattern the coiled handle would leave if I put something on it and pressed the handle against paper.
Yeah, we found pounded-up chicken in the garbage, and a pillowcase with barbecue sauce on it, like maybe from your rolling the handle around.
He doesn't think such an experimentation is odd. He knows I engage in a lot of unusual research when I'm trying to figure out what happened to somebody.
But no chipping hammer. We didn't find that. Not with or without barbecue sauce, Marino goes on. So I'm wondering if asshole Tally swiped it. Maybe you ought to get Lucy and Tian to turn their secret squirrel organization on him and see what they find out, huh? The last precinct's first big investigation. I'd like to run a credit check on the bastard and see where he gets all his money from, for starters.
I keep glancing at my watch, timing our drive. The subdivision where Mitch Barbosa lived is 10 minutes from the Fort James Motel. Taupe-clabbered townhouses are new, and there is no vegetation, just raw earth sprinkled with dead young grass and patched with snow. I recognize unmarked police vehicles in the lot when we pull in, 3 Ford Crown Victorias and a Chevrolet Lumina parked in a row. It doesn't escape my attention or Marino's that 2 of these vehicles have Washington, D.C. plates.
Oh, shit, Marino says. I smell the feds. Oh, boy, he says to me as we park. This ain't good.
I notice a curious detail as Marino and I follow the brick walkway to the townhouse where Barbosa lived with his alleged girlfriend. Through an upstairs window I see a fishing rod. It leans against the glass, and I don't know why it strikes me as out of place except that this isn't the time of year for fishing, just as it isn't the time of year for camping. Again I think of the mysterious, if not mythical, people who fled the campground, leaving behind many of their possessions. I return to Bev Kiffin's lie, and feel I am moving deeper into a dangerous airspace where there are forces I can't see or understand, moving at incredible speeds. Marino and I wait at the front door of Townhouse D, and he rings the bell again. Detective Stanfield answers and greets us distractedly, his eyes darting everywhere. Tension between him and Marino is a wall between them.
"Sorry I didn't make it by the motel," he announces curtly as he steps aside to let us in. "Something's come up. You'll see that in a minute," he promises.
He is in gray corduroys and a heavy wool sweater, and he won't meet my eyes either. I'm not sure if this is because he knows how I feel about his leaking information to his brother-in-law, Representative Dinwiddie, or if there is some other reason. It flashes across my thoughts that he might know I am being investigated for murder. I try not to think about that reality. It serves no good purpose to worry right now.
"Everybody's upstairs," he says, and we follow him up.
"Who's everybody?" Marino asks.
Our feet thud quietly on carpet. Stanfield keeps moving. He doesn't turn around or pause when he replies, ATF and the FBI. I notice framed photographs arranged on the wall to the left of the staircase and take a moment to peruse them, recognizing Mitch Barbosa grinning with tipsy-looking people in a bar and hanging out the window of the cab of a transfer truck. In one photograph, he is sunbathing in a bikini on a tropical beach, maybe Hawaii. He holds up a drink, toasting the person behind the camera. Several other poses are with a pretty woman, the girlfriend he lives with, I wonder. Halfway up is a landing, and the window the fishing pole leans against. I stop, a strange sensation lightly whispering across my flesh as I examine, without touching, a Shakespeare fiberglass rod and Shimano reel. A hook and split-shot weights are attached to the fishing line, and on the carpet next to the rod's handle is a small blue plastic tackle box. Nearby, as if set down when someone entered the townhouse, are two empty Rolling Rock beer bottles, a new pack of Tipperillo cigars, and some change. Marino turns around to see what I am doing. I join him at the top of the stairs, and we emerge into a brightly lit living area that is attractively decorated in spare modern furniture and Indian rugs. "When's the last time you went fishing?" I ask Marino.
"Not fresh water," he replies. "Not around here these days."
"Exactly." I am cut off by an awareness that I know one of the three people standing near the picture window in the living room. My heart jumps when the familiar dark head turns to me, and suddenly I am facing Jay Talley. He doesn't smile, his glance sharp as if his eyes are tipped like arrows. Marino makes a barely audible noise that is like a groan from a small primitive animal. It is his way of letting me know that Jay is the last person he wants to see. Another man in a suit and tie is young and looks Hispanic, and when he sets down his coffee cup, his jacket falls open and reveals a shoulder holster holding a large-caliber pistol. The third person is a woman. She doesn't demonstrate the devastated, confused demeanor of a person whose lover has just been killed. She is upset, yes, but her emotions are well contained beneath the surface, and I recognize the flare in her eyes and angry set of her jaw. I have seen the look in Lucy, in Marino, and others who are more than bereft when something bad happens to a person they care about. Cops. Cops are offended and in an eye-for-an-eye mode when something happens to one of their own. Mitch Barbosa's girlfriend, I suspect right away, is law enforcement, probably undercover. In a matter of minutes, the scenario has dramatically shifted.
"This is Bunk Pruitt, FBI." Stanfield makes introductions. "Jay Talley, ATF." Jay shakes my hand as if we have never met. "And Jillison McIntyre."
Her handshake is cool but firm.
"Ms. McIntyre's ATF."
We find chairs and arrange them so all of us can look at each other and talk. The air is hard. It is flinty with anger. I recognize the mood. I've seen it so many times when a cop is killed. Now that Stanfield has set the stage, he slips behind a curtain of sullen silence. Bunk Pruitt takes charge. Typical FBI.
"Dr. Scarpetta, Captain Marino," Pruitt begins. "I want to state the obvious right off. This is highly, highly sensitive. To be honest, I hate saying anything about what's going on, but you got to know what you're dealing with."
His jaw muscles bunch.
"Mitch Barbosa was undercover FBI. Working a big investigation here in this area, which now, of course, we have to dismantle, at least to a certain degree."
"Drugs and guns," Jay says, glancing from Marino to me. Chapter 24. Is Interpol involved? I don't understand why Jay Talley is here. Barely 2 weeks ago, he was working in France.
"Well, you should know," Jay says, with a trace of sarcasm, or maybe I imagine it.
"The unidentified case you just contacted Interpol about? The guy who died in the motel down the road? We have an idea who he might be. So yes, Interpol's involved. Now we are, you bet."
"I wasn't aware we'd gotten a response from Interpol."
Marino barely tries to be civil to Jay. So you're telling me the guy from the motel's some sort of international fugitive, maybe?
Yes, Jay replies.
Rosso Matos, 28-year-old native of Colombia, as in South America. Last seen in Los Angeles. Also known as the Cat because he's such a quiet guy when he goes in and out of places, killing. That's his specialty. Taking people out. A hitman. Matos has a reputation for liking very expensive clothes, cars, and young men. I guess I need to talk about him in the past tense.
Jay pauses.
No one responds beyond looking at him. What none of us understands is what he was doing here in Virginia, Jay adds. What exactly is the operation here? Marino asks Jillison McIntyre.
Started 4 months ago with a guy speeding along Route 5 just a couple miles from here. A James City cop pulled him. She glances at Stanfield. Runs his tag and finds out he's a convicted felon. Plus the officer happens to notice the handle of a long gun protruding from under a blanket in the back seat. Turns out to be a Mac 90 with the serial number ground off. Our labs in Rockville managed to restore the SN and traced the weapon to a shipment from China. A regular shipment to Richmond. As you know, a Mac 90 is a popular knockoff of the AK-47 assault rifle, going rate of $1,000-$2,000 on the street. Gang members love the Mac, made in China, regularly shipped to local ports in Richmond, Norfolk, legitly in crates accurately marked. Other Macs are being smuggled in from Asia along with heroin, in all kinds of crates marked everything from electronics to oriental rugs. In an all-business voice that only occasionally reveals the strain she feels, McIntyre describes a smuggling ring that, in addition to area ports, involves the James City County Trucking Company where Barbosa was undercover as a driver and she was undercover as his girlfriend. He got her a job in the company's office, where bills of lading and invoices were falsified to disguise a very lucrative operation that also involves cigarettes en route from Virginia to New York and other destinations in the Northeast. Some weapons are being sold through a dirty gun dealer in this area, but a lot of them end up in backroom sales at gun shows, and we all know how many gun shows Virginia has, McIntyre says.
What's the name of the trucking company? Marino asks.
Overland.
Marino's eyes dart to me. He runs his fingers through his thinning hair. Christ, he says to everyone. That's who Bev Kiffin's husband works for. Jesus Christ. The lady who owns and runs the Fort James Motel, Stanfield explains to the others. Overland's a big company and not everybody is involved in illegal activity. Pruitt is quick to be objective. That's what makes this so tough. The company and most people in it are legit. So you could pull their trucks all day and never find anything hot inside a single one of them. Then, on another day, a shipload of paper products, televisions, whatever, heads out, and stashed inside boxes are assault rifles and drugs.
You think someone put the dime on Mitch? Marino asks Pruitt. And the bad guys decided to whack him?
If so, then why is Matos dead, too? It is Jay who speaks.
And it appears Matos died first, right?
He looks at me.
He's found dead in these really weird circumstances, in a motel right down the road. Then the next day, Mitch's body is dumped in Richmond. Plus, Matos is an 800-pound gorilla. I don't see what his interest would be here. Even if someone out there dimed Mitch, you don't send in a hitman like Matos. He's pretty much reserved for big prey in powerful crime organizations. Guys hard to get to because they are surrounded by their own heavily armed thugs.
Who does Matos work for? Marino asks.
Do we know that?
Whoever will pay, Pruitt replies.
He's all over the map, Jay adds. South America, Europe, this country. He's not associated with any one network or cartel, but is a lone operator. You want someone taken out, you hire Matos.
Then someone hired him to come here, I conclude.
We have to assume that, Jay replies. I don't think he was in the area to check out Jamestown or the Christmas decorations in Williamsburg.
We also know he didn't kill Mitch Barbosa, Marino adds. Matos was already dead and on the dock's table before Mitch went out jogging.
There are nods around the room. Stanfield is picking at a fingernail. He looks lost in space, extremely uncomfortable. He keeps wiping sweat off his brow and drying his fingers on his pants. Marino asks Jillison McIntyre to tell us exactly what happened. "Mitch likes to run midday before lunch," she begins. "He went out close to noon and didn't come back. This was yesterday. I went out in the car looking for him around 2 o'clock, and when there was still no sign, I called the police and, of course, our guys, ATF and FBI. Agents came in from the field and started looking, too. Nothing. We know he was spotted in the area of the law school."
"Marshall with?" I inquire, taking notes.
"Right, at William and Mary. Mitch usually ran the same route from here along Route 5, then over on Francis Street and to South Henry, then back. Usually an hour or so."
"Do you remember what he was wearing and what he might have had with him?" I ask her.
"Red warm-up suit and a vest. He had on a down vest over his warm-up.
Gray, North Face.
And his butt pack. He never went anywhere without his butt pack."
"He had a gun in it?" Marino assumes.
She nods, swallowing, face stoical.
"Gun, money, portable phone, house keys."
"He wasn't wearing the down jacket when his body was found," Marino informs her. "No butt pack. Describe the key."
"Keys," she corrects him. "He has the key for here, for the townhouse, and his car key on a steel ring."
"What does the key for your townhouse look like?" I ask, and I feel Jay staring at me.
"Just a brass key. A normal-looking key."
"He had a stainless steel key in the pocket of his running shorts," I say. "It has 233 written on it in permanent magic marker."
Agent McIntyre frowns. She knows nothing about it.
"Well, now, that's really strange. I have no idea what that key might be to," she replies.
"So we gotta figure he was taken somewhere," Marino says. "He was tied up, gagged, tortured, then driven to Richmond and dumped in the street in one of our lovely projects, Mosby Court."
"Hot drug trafficking area?" Pruitt asks him.
"Oh, yeah. The projects are big into economic development. Guns and drugs, you bet."
Marino knows his turf.
"But the other nice thing about places like Mosby Court is people don't see nothing. You want to dump a body? Don't matter if 50 people were standing right there. They get temporary blindness, amnesia."
"Someone familiar with Richmond, then?"
Stanfield finally offers an opinion. McIntyre's eyes are wide. She has a stricken expression on her face.
"I didn't know about torture," she says to me. Her professional resolve shivers like a tree about to fall. I describe Barbosa's burns and go into detail about the burns Matos had as well. I talk about the evidence of ligatures and gags, and then Marino talks about the eye bolts in the motel room ceiling. All present get the picture. Everyone can envision what was done to these two men. We have to suspect the same person or persons are involved in their deaths. But this doesn't begin to tell us who or why. We don't know where Barbosa was taken, but I have an idea.
"When you go back there with Vander," I say to Marino, "maybe you ought to check out the other rooms, see if another one has eye bolts in the ceiling."
"Will do. Got to go back there anyway."
He glances at his watch.
"Today?" Jay asks him.
"Yup."
"You got any reason to think Mitch was drugged like the first guy?" Pruitt asks me.
"I didn't find any needle marks," I reply, "but we'll see what comes up on his tox results."
"Jesus," McIntyre mutters.
"And both of them wet their pants?" Stanfield says.
"Doesn't that happen when people die? They lose control of their bladders and wet their pants? Just a natural thing, in other words?"
"I can't say losing urine is rare. But the first man, Matos, took his clothes off. He was nude. It appears he wet his pants and then disrobed."
"So that was before he got burned," Stanfield says.
"I would assume so. He wasn't burned through his clothing," I reply. "It's very possible both victims lost control of their bladders due to fear, panic. You get scared badly enough, you wet your pants."
"Jesus," McIntyre mutters again.
and you see some asshole screwing eye bolts in the ceiling and plugging in a heat gun, that's enough to scare the piss right out of you, Marino abundantly illustrates. You know damn well what's about to happen to you.
Jesus, McIntyre blurts out. What the fuck is this about?
Her eyes blaze.
Silence. Why the fuck would someone do something like that to Mitch? And it's not like he wasn't careful. Not like he would just get in someone's car or even get close to some stranger trying to stop him on the road.
Stanfield says, makes me think of Vietnam. The way they did things to prisoners of war. Tortured them to make them talk.
Making someone talk can certainly be one reason for torture, I respond to what Stanfield has just said. But it's also a power rush. Some people are into torture because they get off on it.
You think that's the case here? Pruitt says to me.
I have no way of knowing.
Then I ask McIntyre,
I noticed a fishing pole when I was coming up the walk.
Her reaction is a flicker of confusion. Then she realizes what I am talking about.
Oh, right. Mitch likes to fish.
Around here?
A creek over near College Landing Park.
I look at Marino.
That particular creek is at the edge of the wooded camping area at the Fort James Motel.
Mitch ever mentioned to you the motel over there by that creek? Marino asks her.
I just know he liked to fish over there.
He know the lady who runs the joint? Bev Kiffin? And her husband? Maybe you both know him since he works for Overland, Marino says to McIntyre.
Well, I do know that Mitch used to talk to her boys. She has two young boys, and sometimes they'd be out there fishing when Mitch was. He said he felt for them because their dad was never around. But I don't know anybody named Kiffin at the trucking company, and I do their books.
Can you check that out? Jay says.
Maybe his last name's different from hers.
Yeah.
She nods.
You remember the last time Mitch went fishing out there? Marino asks her.
Right before all the snow, she replies. It was pretty nice weather up until then.
I noticed some change. A couple beer bottles and some cigars on the landing, I say.
Right by the fishing pole.
You sure he hasn't been fishing out there since it snowed? Marino picks up my thought.
The expression in her eyes makes it evident that she isn't sure. I wonder just how much she really knows about her undercover boyfriend.
Any illegal shit going on at the motel that you and Mitch are aware of? Marino asks her.
McIntyre starts shaking her head. He never mentioned anything about that. Nothing like that. His only connection to the place was fishing and being nice to the two boys on occasion, if he saw them.
Just if they happened up when he was fishing?
Marino keeps pushing.
Any reason to think Mitch might have ever wandered over to the house to say hi to them?
She hesitates.
Mitch a generous guy?
Oh, yes, she says. Very much so. He might have wandered over. I don't know. He really likes kids.
Liked them.
She tears up again and at the same time simmers.
How did he identify himself to people around here? He say he was a truck driver? What did he say about you? You supposed to be a career woman? Now, you two weren't really boyfriend and girlfriend. That was just part of the front, right?
Marino is on to something. He is leaning forward, his arms braced on his knees, staring intensely at Jellison McIntyre. When he gets like this, he fires questions so rapidly people often don't have time to answer. Then they get confused and say something they regret. She does that this very moment.
Hey, I'm not a fucking suspect, she snaps at him. And our relationship, I don't know what you're getting at. It was professional. But you can't help being close to someone when you live in the same damn townhouse and act like you're involved, make people think you are.
But you weren't involved, Marino says.
Or at least he wasn't with you. You guys were doing a job, right? Meaning, if he wanted to pay attention to a lonely woman with two nice little boys, he could do that.
Marino leans back in his chair. The room is so silent, it seems to hum.
Problem is, Mitch shouldn't have done that. Dangerous, fucking stupid in light of his situation. He one of those types who had a hard time keeping his pants on?
She doesn't answer him. Tears jump out.
You know what, folks? Marino scans the room.
It just might be that Mitch got tangled up in something that doesn't have a damn thing to do with your undercover operation here. Wrong place, wrong time. Caught something he sure as hell wasn't fishing for.
You got any idea where Mitch was at 3 o'clock Wednesday afternoon when Matos checked into the motel and the fire started?
Stanfield is putting the pieces together.
Was he here or out somewhere?
No, he wasn't here, she barely says, wiping her eyes with a tissue. Gone. I don't know where.
Marino blows out in disgust. He doesn't need to say it. Undercover partners are supposed to keep track of each other. And if Agent McIntyre didn't always know where Special Agent Barbosa was, then he was up to something that maybe wasn't germane to their investigation.
I know you don't even want to think it, Jillison, Marino goes on in a milder tone. But Mitch was tortured and murdered, okay? I mean the guy was fucking scared to death. Literally. Whatever someone was doing to him, it was so awful he had a fucking heart attack. He wet his fucking pants. He was taken somewhere and strung up, gagged, and then has a weirdo key put in his pocket. Planted. What for? Why? He into anything we ought to know about, Jillison? He fishing for more than bass out there in that creek by the playground?
Tears are rolling down McIntyre's face. She wipes them away roughly with the tissue and sniffles loudly.
He liked drinking and women, she barely says. Okay.
He ever go out at night, bar hopping and that sort of thing?
Pruitt asks her.
She nods. It was part of his cover.
You saw, her eyes jump to me.
You saw him, his dyed hair, the earring, all the rest. Mitch played the role of a sort of, well, wild party guy, and he did like the women. He never pretended to be, faithful to me, to his so-called girlfriend. It was part of his cover. But it was also him.
Yeah, I worried about it, okay? But that was Mitch. He was a good agent.
I don't think he did anything dishonest, if that's what you're asking. But he didn't tell me everything, either. If he got onto something going on at the playground, for example, he might have started poking around. He might have.
Without letting you know, Marino confirms.
She nods again.
And I was out doing my thing, too. It's not like I was here every minute waiting for him. I was working in the office at Overland, part-time anyway, so we didn't always know what the other was up to every hour of every day.
I'll tell you this much, Marino decides. Mitch stumbled onto something, and I'm just wondering if he wasn't out at the motel around the time Matos showed up, and maybe whatever Matos was into, Mitch had the misfortune of being spotted in the area. Maybe it's just that simple. Somebody thinks he saw something, knew something, and next thing he gets picked up and gets the treatment.
No one argues. Marino's theory actually is the only one so far that makes any sense.
Which brings us back to what Matos was doing here to begin with, Pruitt comments.
I look at Stanfield. He has wandered out of the conversation. His face is wan. He is a nervous wreck. His eyes drift to me and quickly move away. He wets his lips and coughs several times. Detective Stanfield, I feel compelled to say to him in front of everyone, for God's sake, don't tell any of this to your brother-in-law. Anger sparks in his eyes. I have humiliated him and don't care. Please, I add.
You want to know the truth? He angrily retorts. I don't want nothing to do with any of this.
He slowly draws himself to his feet and looks around the room, blinking, his eyes glazing over.
I don't know what this is all about, but I don't want no part, I mean no part of it. You feds are in it already up to your eyeballs, so you can just have it. I quit.
He nods.
You heard me right. I quit.
Detective Stanfield, to our amazement, collapses. He falls so hard the room shakes. I spring up. Thank God he is breathing. His pulse is running wild, but he is not in the grips of a cardiac arrest or anything life-threatening. He simply has fainted. I check his head to make sure he hasn't injured himself. He is all right. He comes to. Marino and I help him to his feet and get him on the couch. I make him lie down and prop several pillows under his neck. Most of all, he is embarrassed, acutely so. Detective Stanfield, are you diabetic? I ask.
Do you have a heart condition?
If you just got a Coke or something, that would be good, he says weakly.
I get up and head into the kitchen. Let me see what I can do, I say, as if I live here. Inside the refrigerator, I get out orange juice. I find peanut butter in a cabinet and scoop out a big spoonful. It is while I am looking for paper towels that I notice a prescription bottle by the toaster oven. Mitch Barbosa's name is on the label. He was taking the antidepressant Prozac. When I return to the living room, I say something about this to McIntyre, and she tells us that Barbosa went on Prozac several months ago because he was suffering anxiety and depression, which he blamed on the undercover assignment, on stress, she adds.
That's interesting, is all Marino has to say about it.
You said you're going back to the motel when you leave here? Jay asks Marino.
Yeah, Vander's going to see if we might have any luck with Prince.
Prince? Stanfield murmurs from his sickbed.
Jesus, Stanfield, Marino blurts out in exasperation. They teach you anything in detective school? Or did you get sent ahead several grades because of your goddamn brother-in-law?
He is a goddamn brother-in-law, you want to know the truth. He says this so pitifully and with such candor that everybody laughs. Stanfield perks up a little bit. He sits higher against the pillows.
And you're right, he meets my eyes. I shouldn't have told him one peep about this case, and I won't tell him nothing else. Not a word, because it's all politicking to that one. It wasn't me who dragged in this whole Jamestown thing, just so you know.
Pruitt frowns. What Jamestown thing?
Oh, you know, the dig out there and the big celebration the state's planning. Well, thing is, if the truth be known, Dinwiddie got no more Indian blood in him than I do. All this horse crap about him being a descendant of Chief Powhatan. Pshaw!
Stanfield's eyes dance with resentment that I doubt he rarely touches. He probably hates his brother-in-law.
Mitch has Indian blood, McIntyre says somberly. He's half Native American.
Well, for Christ's sake, let's hope the newspapers don't find that out, Marino mutters to Stanfield, not buying for one second that Stanfield is going to keep his mouth shut.
We got a gay guy and now an Indian. Oh boy, Marino shakes his head. We got to keep this out of politics, out of circulation, and I mean it.
He stares right at Stanfield, then at Jay.
Because guess what? We can't talk about what we think is really going on, now can we? About the big undercover operation? About Mitch being undercover FBI? And that maybe, in some Fruit Loop way, Sean Dunn is all wrapped around whatever the shit's going on out here. So if people get all caught up in this hate crime shit, how do we turn that around when we can't tell the truth?
I don't agree, Jay says to him. I'm not ready to say what these murders are about. I'm not prepared to accept, for example, that Matos and now Barbosa aren't related to gun smuggling. I do think without a doubt their murders are connected.
No one disagrees. The modi operandi are too similar for the deaths not to be related, and in fact committed by the same person or persons.
I'm also not prepared to totally ignore the idea that they're hate crimes, Jay goes on.
A gay male? A Native American? He shrugs.
Torture's pretty damn hateful.
Any injuries to their genitalia?
He turns to me.
No.
I hold his gaze.
It is odd to think we were intimate, to look at his full lips and graceful hands and to remember their touch. When we walked the streets of Paris, people turned to stare at him.
He says. I find that interesting and maybe important. I'm not a forensic psychiatrist, of course, but it does seem in hate crimes the perpetrators rarely injure the victim's genitals.
Marino gives him an incredible look, his mouth parting in blatant disdain.
Because you get some redneck homophobic sort and the last thing he's going to go near is the guy's genitals, Jay adds.
Well, if you really want to go around this mulberry bush, Marino acidly says to him, then let's just connect it to Sean Dunn. He never went near his victim's genitals either. Shit, he didn't even take their fucking pants off, just beat and bit the shit out of their faces and breasts. only lower body thing he did at all was to take off their shoes and socks and bite their feet. And why? The guy's afraid of female genitalia because his own's as deformed as the rest of him.
Marino surveys the faces around him.
One good thing about the bastard being locked up is we got to find out what the rest of him looks like. Right? And guess what? He ain't got a dick. Or let's just say that what he's got I wouldn't call a dick.
Stanfield is sitting straight up on the couch now, his eyes wide in amazement.
I'll go with you to the motel, Jay says to Marino.
Marino gets up and looks out the window.
Wonder where the hell Vander is, he says.
He gets Vander on the cell phone and we head out minutes later to meet in the parking lot. Jay walks with me. I feel the energy of his desire to talk to me, to somehow come to a consensus. In this way, he is like the stereotype of a woman. He wants to talk, to settle matters, to have closure, or to rekindle our connection so he can then play hard to get again. I, on the other hand, want none of it.
Kay, can I have a minute? He says in the parking lot. I stop and look at him as I button my coat.
I notice Marino glancing our way as he gets the trash bags and baby carriage out of the back of his truck and loads them into Vander's car.
I know this is awkward, but is there some way we can make it easier? For one thing, we have to work together, Jay says.
Maybe you should have thought about that before you told Jamie Berger every detail, Jay, I reply.
That wasn't against you. His eyes are intense.
Right. She asked me questions, understandably. She's just doing her job. I don't believe him. That is my fundamental problem with Jay Talley. I don't trust him and wish I never had.
Well, that's curious, I comment, because it appears people started asking questions about me before Diane Bray was even murdered. Right about the time I was with you in France, inquiries began, as a matter of fact.
His expression darkens. Anger peers out before he can hide it.
You're paranoid, Kay, he says.
You're right, I reply. You're absolutely right, Jay.
Chapter 25. I have never driven Marino's Dodge Ram quad cab pickup truck, and were circumstances not so strained, I would probably find the scenario comical. I am not a big person, barely 5'5", slender, and there is nothing funky or extreme about me. I do wear jeans, but not today. I suppose I dress like a proper chief or lawyer, usually in a tailored skirt suit or flannel trousers and a blazer, unless I am working a crime scene. I wear my blonde hair short and neatly styled, am light on makeup, and, other than my signet ring and watch, jewelry is an afterthought. I don't have a single tattoo. I don't look like the sort who would be roaring along in a monster macho truck that is dark blue with pinstriping, chrome, mud flaps, scanner, and big swooping antennas that go with the CB and two-way radios. I take 64 West back to Richmond because it is quicker, and I pay close attention to my driving because it is a lot to handle a vehicle this size with only one arm. I have never spent a Christmas Eve like this, and I am increasingly depressed over the notion. Usually, by now, I have stocked the refrigerator and freezer, and have cooked sauces and soups and decorated the house. I feel utterly homeless and alien as I drive Marino's truck along the interstate, and it occurs to me that I don't know where I will sleep tonight. I guess at Anna's, but I dread the necessary chill between us. I didn't even see her this morning, and a helpless feeling of loneliness settles over me and seems to push me down in my seat. I page Lucy. I've got to move back into my house tomorrow, I tell her on the phone. Maybe you should stay in the hotel with Tian and me, she suggests. How about you and Tian stay with me? It is so hard for me to express a need, and I need them, I do, for a lot of reasons.
When do you want us there?
We'll have Christmas together in the morning.
Early.
Lucy has never stayed in bed past 6 on Christmas morning.
I'll be up, and then we'll go to the house, I tell her.
December 24.
Days have gotten as short as they can, and it will be a while before light savors the hours and burns off my heavy, anxious moods. It is dark by the time I reach downtown Richmond, and when I pull up to Anna's house at 6:05, I find Berger waiting for me in her Mercedes SUV, headlights penetrating the night. Anna's car is gone. She is not home. I don't know why this unsettles me so completely, unless it is that I am suspicious she somehow knows Berger is meeting me and chose not to be here. Considering such a possibility reminds me that Anna has talked to people and may one day be forced to reveal what I have told her during my most vulnerable hours in her home. Berger climbs out as I open the truck door, and if she is taken aback by my transportation, she makes no indication of it. "Do you need anything from inside the house before we go?" she asks. "Give me just a minute," I tell her. "Was Dr. Zenner here when you arrived?" I feel her stiffen a little. "I got here just a few minutes before you did." "Evasion," I think, as I climb the front steps. I unlock the door and turn off the burglar alarm. The foyer is dark, the great chandelier and Christmas tree lights off. I write Anna a note and thank her for her friendship and hospitality. I need to return to my own home tomorrow, and know she will understand why I must. Mostly I want her to believe I am not upset with her, that I realize she is as victimized by circumstances as I am. I say circumstances because I am no longer sure who is holding a gun to Anna's head and ordering her to divulge confidences about me. Rocky Caggiano may be next in line unless I am indicted. If that should happen, I will be no factor in Sean Dunn's trial, not hardly. I leave the note on Anna's immaculately made Biedermeier bed. Then I get in Berger's car and begin to tell her about my day in James City County, about the abandoned campsite and the long, pale hairs. She listens intently, driving, knowing where she is going as if she has lived in Richmond all of her life. "Can we prove the hairs are Sean Dunn's?" she finally asks, assuming there are no roots, as usual. "And there weren't roots with the ones found at the crime scenes, right? Your crime scenes, Luong and Bray." "No roots," I say, rankled by the reference to my crime scenes. "They aren't my crime scenes," I silently protest. "He shed those hairs, so there are no roots," I tell Berger. "But we can get mitochondrial DNA from the shafts. So yes, we can definitely know if the hairs from the campground are his." "Please explain," she says. "I'm not an expert on mitochondrial DNA, or an expert on hair, for that matter, especially the kind of hair he has." The subject of DNA is a difficult one. Explaining human life on a molecular level tells most people far more than they can understand or care to know. Cops and prosecutors love what DNA can do. They hate to talk about it scientifically. Few of them understand it. The old joke is, most people can't even spell DNA. I explain that nuclear DNA is what we get when cells with nuclei are present, such as with blood, tissue, seminal fluid, and hair roots. Nuclear DNA is inherited equally from both parents. So if we have someone's nuclear DNA, we have in a sense all of him, and can compare his DNA profile to any other biological sample this same person has left at, say, another crime scene. "Can we just compare the hairs from the campground to the hairs he left at the murder scenes?" Berger asks. "Not successfully," I reply. "Examining microscopic characteristics in this instance won't tell us much because the hairs are unpigmented. The most we will be able to say is their morphologies are similar or consistent with each other." "Not conclusive to a jury," she thinks out loud. "Not in the least. If we don't do a microscopic comparison anyway, the defense will bring that up," Berger considers. "He'll say, 'Why didn't you?' Well, we can microscopically compare the hairs if you want. The ones from Susan Pless's body and the ones from your cases. If you want," I repeat. "Explain hair shafts. How does DNA work with those?" I tell her that mitochondrial DNA is found in the walls of cells and not in their nuclei,
meaning mitochondrial DNA is the anthropological DNA of hair, fingernail, tooth, and bone. Mitochondrial DNA is the molecules that make up our mortar and stone, I say. The limited usefulness lies in that mitochondrial DNA is inherited only through the female lineage. I use the analogy of an egg. Think of mitochondrial DNA as the egg white, while nuclear DNA is the yolk. You can't compare one to the other, but if you have DNA from blood, you have the whole egg, and can compare mitochondrial to mitochondrial, egg white to egg white. We have blood because we have Shandun. He had to give up a blood sample while in the hospital. We have his complete DNA profile, and can compare the mitochondrial DNA of unknown hairs to the mitochondrial DNA from his blood sample. Berger listens without interruption. She has taken in what I am saying and seems to understand. As usual, she takes no notes. She asks, "Did he leave hair at your house?" "I'm not sure what the police found." "As much as he seems to shed, I would think he left hair at your house or certainly out in the snow in your yard when he was thrashing about."
"You would think so." I agree with her.
"I've been reading about werewolves." Berger leaps to the next topic. "Apparently there have been people who really thought they were werewolves or tried all sorts of bizarre things to turn themselves into werewolves. Witchcraft, black magic, Satan worship, biting, drinking blood. Do you think it's possible Shandun really believes he is a loup-garou, a werewolf, and maybe even wants to be one?"
"Thus not guilty by reason of insanity," I reply. "And I have assumed all along this would be his defense."
"There was a Hungarian countess in the early 1600s, Elizabeth Báthory Nádasdy, also known as the Blood Countess," Berger goes on. "She supposedly tortured and murdered some 600 young women, would bathe in their blood, believing it would keep her young and preserve her beauty. Familiar with the case?"
"Vaguely."
"As the story goes, this countess kept young women in her dungeon, fattened them up, would bleed them and bathe in their blood, and then force other imprisoned women to lick all the blood off her body, supposedly because towels were harsh on her skin. Rubbing blood in her skin all over her body," she ponders. "Accounts of this have left out the obvious. I'd say there was a sexual component," she adds dryly. "Lust murders. Even if the perpetrator truly believed in the magical powers of blood, it's about power and sex. That's what it's about, whether you're a beautiful countess or some genetic anomaly who grew up on the Ile Saint-Louis." We turn on Canterbury Road, entering the wooded, wealthy neighborhood of Windsor Farms, where Diane Bray lived on the outer edge, her property separated by a wall from the noisy downtown expressway.
"I would give my right arm to know what's in the Shandun library," Berger is saying.
"Or better put, what sorts of things Shandun's been reading over the years,